The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum of Accelerated Government Strategies, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum from Accelerated Government Strategies, providing advisory consulting for innovative startups to help grow government revenue. Every week, Aileen and Gigi welcome Washington, D.C.'s most ambitious and influential female executives who are taking risks to engineer success and shape the future. Women of Washington on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now your hosts, Aileen Black and Gigi Shum.
I'm Aileen Black.
And I'm Gigi Shum.
Today, our guest is Heather Podesta. In 2007, Heather founded Heather Podesta & Partners, which is the nation's largest women-owned government relations firm. Heather Podesta & Partners is a leading legislative and public policy strategist with experience on Capitol Hill and in the private sector. Heather & Podesta Partners was recently named one of D.C.'s top 50 government relations firms by the National Law Journal.
Tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what your family was like.
So I grew up in Rochester, New York, the daughter of two academics. My father is a mathematician. My mother has a Ph.D. in computer science. And so it was a very binary home, ones and zeros, right and wrong, white, black, and very focused on academics. And from a very early age, my folks said that I would be the lawyer and my sister would be the doctor because I was the argumentative one and she was the loving, caring one.
And is that what happened?
Exactly what happened. And so my sister is a doctor at a federally qualified healthcare center in St. Louis, helping the neediest of the needy. And I ended up as a lawyer lobbyist. And I don't think my parents could be prouder of the two of us. But a big focus on academics, no connection at all to politics.
I, like you, was the product of two very science-oriented people. I was an English major, and I kind of felt like the black sheep of the family going a different route. Did you feel like that, too?
Absolutely. And, it's sort of ironic that I ended up working on issues that live in the gray, that you don't have the luxury of something being white or black. And so growing up, it was challenging, and to try to understand how to move forward, where I have a mind that doesn't see things as a mathematical equation. So I totally empathize with you being an English major in a household like that.
In doing research for the interview, I heard you referred to as the insider insider. Wow, that sounds like a star of a TV show almost. So how does somebody start on a journey to be an insider? What was your first job, or how did you get to D.C.?
So my first job in D.C. was I worked at the Congressional Budget Office, and I fell in love with the budget. I know that sounds super geeky. But at the same time fell in love with the city and was really fortunate because I got to do some research on the North American Free Trade Act and got excited about trade policy. So I finished up college at Berkeley, came back to D.C. and had the good fortune of working for Senator Bill Bradley and worked to push for the passage of NAFTA. And it was an extraordinary experience as a 23-year-old to work on such an important piece of legislation, which is still affecting us today and is clearly part of the political conversation of the moment.
What a big responsibility for 23. Were you ready to take on such a big responsibility at 23? Or what strategies did you use to help you work through some of the roles and responsibilities you had at that time?
So at 23, any 23-year-old thinks that they can run the world. And so the arrogance of age or a young age is really an amazing thing. It didn't mean that I wasn't nervous or scared or worried. And so anytime I wrote a memo to the senator, I must have reread it 10 times, read it out loud, you know, made slight changes, agonized over every word in the memo for fear of screwing something up. I mean, for me, I have always been a perfectionist, and especially at 23, where you're ready to take on the world, but at the same time, you have no knowledge, limited skills. And so it was an amazing experience. And also, it was an office filled with hyper-educated folks. And so reaching out to other folks in the office for help and support was invaluable. But I also realized, hey, everyone here has a graduate degree, and I'm just a graduate. I need to actually go and get a law degree. So I was only on the Hill for a year and then went off to UVA for law school.
It sounds like you felt like you needed a degree. How did you decide on law versus something else, public policy or many of the other things you could have gone back to get a degree in?
I spoke to a lot of people, and it seemed as though the law degree would give me the most flexibility to continue my interest in public policy, but also I had been brainwashed as a small child that you are the lawyer in the family. You should become a lawyer. And so you go in straight lines at times in your career. And, you know, I feel like the first 25 years of my life, it was very much directed by my parents and their plans for me. And so law school seemed like a natural thing. My plan was always to return to Capitol Hill. But I really liked practicing law. I went after my second year of law school and worked at a firm and fell in love with it. And I realized that to become a lawyer, it wasn't enough to get the degree. I actually needed to practice for a while. And so when I graduated, I did go to a firm and I learned how to write. I learned how to think. I learned how to service clients, and it was a hugely valuable but horribly intense, agonizing time period in my career, because it was just a lot of work that, you know, no pain, no gain. You really, in order to learn a profession, you have to put the time in and actually learn skills.
And so did you think at that time that you would continue and maybe go on the partner track, or did you always know that was sort of a stopping point and then you would get back on the Hill?
I sort of got carried away with the practice of law and was really enjoying it. And one of our one of the firm's clients asked me to go in-house. And it seemed like a new challenge, and it was great fun to go in my then late 20s and go to the Air Transport Association, which is represents all the major U.S. carriers and cargo carriers, and was able to work on international noise and emissions issues and represent the U.S. industry in international forums. And it was an unbelievable opportunity to engage in the making of international public law. It was a huge responsibility, but it was also incredibly narrow. And so I learned a lot. And I do think this is something that I learned was there are real benefits to specializing in an area of study or an issue area and becoming one of the top people, even if it's such a small, thin piece of policy, because not only do you learn the policy, but you learn people and you learn process, and it allows you to take those lessons so that when you're able to broaden your policy perspective, you've been operating at the highest levels, and then you can translate that knowledge and that skill.
Today, our guest is Heather Podesta, founder and CEO, Heather Podesta and Partners. Coming up, we'll hear about Heather's experience post 9/11. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, our guest is Heather Podesta, founder and CEO, Heather Podesta and Partners.
So, Heather, before the break, we were just talking about the fact that you were the assistant general counsel for the House Air Transport Association. So sounds like that was a great job. And you talked about the benefit of being so narrowly focused. Why did you decide to leave?
Unfortunately, 9/11 happened and the whole world changed. And that day, we knew early on that it was a terrorist attack. And I remember the general counsel coming into my office and saying, "You're on the go team." And for the next 3 weeks, I spent time communicating between the U.S. government and the carriers. And this is how old school this is going to sound, but faxing lists of suspected, people of suspicion to the airlines and doing it sort of around the clock. And
So they could compare that with the manifest, yes, of the passengers on
exactly.
The
And it was a horrible time for the country. It was a horrible time for the industry. And I had been focused on environmental issues and it all seemed so unimportant. And so I realized that I really needed to return to public policy, that I needed to do something. And so I made the decision to return to Capitol Hill and pick up sort of why I planned to go to law school in the first place. And so had the good fortune of going to work for a member from North Dakota, Earl Pomeroy, and was able to jump in and learn the world of tax law and help him on trade issues as well.
You returned to Capitol Hill and you worked for Congressman Pomeroy and Congressman Matsui.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us, what is a day in the life of a Hill staffer?
It is not your own. It is your job is to support the member of Congress, and you do that any number of ways. But the most important is to make sure that they are prepared for every speech, any possible question, any meeting that they have. So a member of Congress has hearings and meetings and fundraisers on their schedule. And you know, as a staffer, you would prepare a memo for every meeting. Some meetings you were invited to, some you were not. For the hearings, providing background information on witnesses, explaining why this was might be of interest to the district, that there might be district-specific issues at play, and then suggesting possible questions to ask. As well as supporting the congressman, had the additional responsibility of meeting with interested groups that wanted to bend the congressman's ear or were concerned about particular items, and so would sit down with them. I was always second choice, clearly, but oftentimes a very important step in their getting a meeting with the congressman, so that I was briefed and could sort of recommend action to him.
That's a tremendous amount of influence a Hill staffer has. I've worked quite a bit up on the Hill and on technical issues. And these are young people that have a great deal of responsibility because the congressmen are very, very busy. They're looking for the information, and they really look to their staff for some information to get for guidance as to making decisions. Did you feel prepared after law school to be able to be that provider of information?
I definitely felt more prepared the second time on Capitol Hill. And, you know, you sort of think back and go, woo, I did pretty well at 23, but I know a lot more now. And, you know, I think the most important thing a Hill staffer can do is listen to both sides of a debate and list the pros and cons, and then come up with a recommendation or a pathway forward. And ultimately, you know, it's a decision for the member of Congress to make, and you just have to be prepared with the right data. But, you know, it was always nerve-wracking as a young staffer to get called into the office and have the member with your memo in front of them, and then them sort of firing questions at you and really needing to be prepared and smart on them.
Do you think today's environment with so much contention on Capitol Hill is different than when you were working there in that role?
It always feels political. It's a political body. I am an institutionalist. I love Congress. I see things happening when folks say the system is broken. And part of it is you have to accept incremental steps, that the days of big legislation, like a big telecom bill, we don't see that every 5 years. Instead, you'll see smaller legislation pass, but it will never be covered by the press, but it absolutely impacts people where they live.
So what do you think is behind that change in the legislative, I don't want to say process because it's the same process, but the fact that it is smaller bills? I mean, one of the things that we talk about sometimes is just the power that social media has had, and that everybody is hyper-connected 24/7. Every move by everybody is scrutinized. Do you think that is making people less likely to try to take on these grand, causes? Or is it just that it's been so contentious that it's just easier to get small things passed?
I think that there is more transparency in the process, which I think is a good thing, that the American people know what their members of Congress are doing. It I think the biggest change comes from the decision of leadership in one party, the Republican Party, to attack the institution. And you especially saw that in the summer of 2010 with the Tea Party, that just simply wanted to shut Washington down, didn't believe in the institutions. And, when you attack the role of government year after year after year, it does have a corrosive effect, and people lose faith in the institutions and lose faith in the members of Congress that represent them, even if it's their member railing against the machine. And I do think that, while I don't agree with every member of Congress, that they come to Washington in all earnestness to represent their constituents.
In 2007, you took a really bold move and started your own firm, Heather Podesta & Partners. What made you do that?
So when I left the Hill, I went and was a partner at Blank Rome and returned to sort of the practice of lawyering and lobbying, and was really enjoying what I was doing. And I decided, you know what? I am just going to check my value in the marketplace. I'm just, you know, I feel like I'm a little underpaid, but it was a closed compensation scheme, and I use scheme deliberately. And I knew that I had a significant book of business, and my pay did not seem commensurate. And so I started talking to other law firms, and I expected the other firms to sort of suggest, you know, Heather, we'd love to have you. We'll give you another $50,000 a year to come join us. Instead, three different firms said, oh, we'd double your salary. At which point, you have this moment of recognition where it's like, whoa, I'm being taken advantage of. And as I talked to the other firms, I realized it was a matter of different people, same problems in a law firm setting. And so, you know, spoke to folks that I was close to. I spoke to folks that I was not terribly close to sort of explore the idea of starting my own firm. And what I ultimately came to terms with was, all right, Heather, what does failure look like? Like, if you do this, if you start your own firm and it doesn't work out, what's your backup option? And I realized, I'll be a partner in a law firm. Why wouldn't I go for it? And so it very, you know, it was also sort of helped by some of the behavior of folks in my firm that sort of expedited one of the more frustrating, but it served as a good kick in the butt moments. Was I was at a firm holiday party. And I see one of my partners talking to a client that I had brought in, a CEO. And so I walk over there all confident. And as I'm approaching, this partner says to the CEO, "Isn't Heather our most beautiful partner?" And I joked, you know, and talented, and we moved on from there. But for me that night, it was, I actually need to start my firm. I need to do this. And so 3 weeks later, I started my own firm, and I did it at a time where Nancy Pelosi had won back the House, and people realized, wait, who knows House Democrats? and so I started the firm as a Democratic-only firm and made it very clear from day one that we were going to be, you know, a smart, strategic firm and not based on access, but we would have access if we needed it.
Today, our guest is Heather Podesta, founder and CEO, Heather Podesta & Partners. Coming up, we'll ask Heather about life as a lobbyist in D.C. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, our guest is Heather Podesta, founder and CEO, Heather Podesta Partners.
So, Heather, we were just talking about the fact that you made this bold move and decided to start your own firm, a lobbying firm, and lobbyist. I think a lot of people, particularly outside the Beltway, don't understand what lobbyists even do. And even inside the Beltway, sometimes it's considered somewhat of a dirty word. So why don't you talk about what a life of a lobbyist is?
So yes, I am a lobbyist, and I am very proud to be a lobbyist. What does a lobbyist do? A little bit of everything. Under the Constitution, anyone has the right to petition the government, and every part of your life is represented in Washington. And so I represent primarily Fortune 500 companies and tech startups, and I help them navigate Washington. Now, that sounds like lobbyist speak. I get it. What do I actually do? You know, some might say, well, she talks on the phone all day and goes to parties, but it's a lot more than that. Usually a client will come to us with either a problem, or they're wanting to tell Congress or an agency what they're up to. And so we'll sit down with them and work up a strategy of how to solve their problem. And it isn't always clear that you want to take that client. One of the clients I sort of struggled with up front was I got a phone call from a lawyer in town, and he said, oh, I was talking to Carl Rove, and he has a friend who's in the uranium mining business, and they have an EPA issue, and I recommended you. At which point I was like, I don't know if I want to work on this particular issue. It felt like I was being punked, possibly. But when I actually spoke to the CEO and I understood what the problem was, I realized that the agency was not following its own rules, and that this was a small company in Texas that had done all the due diligence, had met every requirement of the law, but it was sort of locked in place, and they weren't getting decisions from the agency, and so came up with a plan to sort of shine a light on the intransigence of the agency. I never thought I'd be the uranium girl, but I'm really proud of the work that we did on that project and that we continue to do on behalf of the industry. I also get to work on really interesting technology issues, as well as we find ourselves almost in front of every congressional committee and every agency, because our client base is incredibly diverse.
So that brings rise to a question, which is, are there any issues that you've been asked to lobby on behalf that you've just said, no, that doesn't make sense for us? It's not who we want our firm to be associated with.
So I do say no. And I say no for a number of reasons. One, I don't believe in the issue. Second, I don't like the people. I mean, I think one of the reasons that our firm has been so successful is that we don't represent jerks. That's paramount, no jerks. and then the third is we don't take on issues where we can't be successful. And so sometimes people not understanding the world of the possible will come in with an absurd ask. And as you try to explain how Washington actually works, they don't get it. Or like, oh, but you know Senator Reid and he can do this. It's like, no, that's not how this works. So I can't represent you.
I watched a video, Heather, of you did an interview with Ezra Klein. And in an interview, you talked about the new face of lobbying. With the laws requiring complete transparency, you have to disclose who you're working for, what you're doing, exactly how much time you do with mm-hmm. them, what they're paying you for. Has this helped or hurt the ability to be able to be an effective lobbyist?
I think in terms of effectiveness, it has had no effect on me and my firm. But, the lobbying rules that President Obama brought in created a situation where people were reluctant to categorize themselves as lobbyists, which meant they started paying very close attention to what the law requires and how you define a lobbyist. And so what ended up happening was people, in terms of doing the fine reading of the law, figured out a way to categorize themselves as non-lobbyists. And so we saw people of significant influence in Washington basically take themselves off of the radar screen and continue to do lobbying activity, but in smaller amounts. And yeah, I'm a big believer in over-disclosure, that I am really proud of the work that we do on behalf of our clients. And yeah, it's a lot of information that's out there about us and the firm and our clients. But that's as it should be. And it shouldn't be stigmatized, but actually encouraged. So we should have similar rules in the areas of public relations and grassroots, as opposed to it all being a big black box.
You know, that's, you know, to me, being able to bring views to your elected officials is what makes America great. And really, that's what lobbyists do. They provide another view to these elected officials so that they can take them to heart and make a vote. Now, you have to ask yourself, if you've limited the kind of people in the population that can do that now, has it maybe, you know, made an administration maybe not as effective because they're not hearing all the views if people are not being encouraged to do that?
I've said more than once that Washington is a fact-free zone. And so if you don't have your facts before Congress or before the administration, they don't exist. And so when you cut off supplies of information, you're only harming your own ability to evaluate the full circumstances of an issue.
Today, our guest is Heather Podesta, founder Heather Podesta and Partners. Coming up, we'll find out what advice Heather would give to her younger self. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, our guest is Heather Podesta, founder and CEO, Heather Podesta and Partners. Heather, the amendment guaranteeing women voting rights is nearly 100 years old. I mean, all those decades, slow progress culminating in Hillary Clinton becoming the first woman to be the nominee of her major party. This slow creep into the presidential campaign reflects a larger trend. Women make up a bigger share of the national and state lawmakers than ever, 20% of our Congress, but it's still a very slow progress. What do you think is going to change that?
Sadly, more time. But the good news is momentum is on the side of women. I think this election cycle has been violent and brutish and really important in that it has highlighted gender issues that have existed for a long time that people simply haven't talked about. I don't think any of us could have anticipated the sort of twists and turns and the sheer ugliness of this campaign. But I think, you know, we have in Hillary Clinton the most qualified person who has ever run for the office of the presidency. And it is extraordinary the walls of fire that she has to walk through every single day. And I think that's true of women today, in any job, anywhere in the U.S., that the standards are different, the expectations are different, and you do have to work harder, and that there are unspoken biases and challenges that some men are aware of, some aren't, but all women know to be true. And it's not something that as a professional you spend a lot of time talking to your colleagues about. and you just put your head down and work a little harder and understand, you know, this is the system, and you understand how to work a system and you try to move forward and pull others along with you.
You know, there's, you know, both Gigi and I have 30 plus years of being in a very dominated sector, high tech industry. We always joke that we never had to wait for a line for the bathroom at manager events. But, you know, do you have any advice for some young woman or a listener out there with political ambitions? What would you do if you wanted to run for an office today in America?
Well, one piece of advice I have for all women, whether they're running for office or they're career focused, is to fundraise. This is one of the most valuable skills that anyone can have. So one way to assure a seat at the table is either by being able to write a big check, which most of us can't do, or by raising money. And this is a skill that is important to your school. This is a skill that's important if you want to go to a private equity firm. And this is a skill that's really important in politics. And I encourage everyone to get engaged in an issue that they care about. I care about politics. I care about electing really good people. And my way of supporting them is by raising money for them. I encourage other folks, especially women, that if there is a cause that they're passionate about, if they are concerned about animal safety, to actively try to raise money to support that cause or that organization. And it's a hugely useful skill. In part, you get used to hearing no and realizing that it's not personal. It's not personal at all. It's just someone else is not interested in your favorite issue. And I think hearing no and being okay with that is really important to get comfortable with, but it also forces you to think about how you're asking for things and understanding, okay, this person may not care about my issue, but they care about these three things. So I'm going to figure out a way to have them realize that my issue is actually connected to those three things, and I'm going to ask in a different way. And so it is a skill that is hugely helpful and oftentimes undervalued, but being able to bring money to a situation, whether it is in a school setting or a business setting or a fundraiser, a political setting, is empowering. I like to say that the golden rule is she who has the gold rules. And so when you come with money, people are forced to listen.
If you were to see Heather going across the stage from law school and you were to whisper in her ear pearls of wisdom that would allow her to achieve the type of success or even greater in today's world, what would you say to her?
The first thing I would say is it's going to be okay, that all of that nervous energy and anxiety and wanting to do great things but having no idea what I actually wanted to do, that to be patient and live in the moment. I think that's something that I've just recently learned, is really embrace where you are, as well as keeping an eye out for the next thing. One of the things that I did learn along the way, which was hugely valuable to my career, was the importance of networking. And I thought that if you were the smartest person, if you worked the hardest, if you were the person in the office until 10 o'clock and then back there at 7 o'clock, that you would be successful and that work would be rewarded. And what I've learned through time is that's not how you're successful. That isn't how you move forward, and that it isn't a metric of time, but sort of what you are accomplishing and what you are doing. And oftentimes it's what you're doing outside of an office situation that is more important to your job and your career than clocking another 3 hours of billable time at a law firm.
You've been listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, our guest has been Heather Podesta, founder, Heather Podesta and Partners. Heather, thank you so much for sharing your inspirational story with us today.
Thank you both.
I'm Gigi Shum.
I'm Aileen Black.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum, founders of Accelerated Government Strategies. Learn more about AGS and the work they do to help accelerate your business plans for public sector at excelgovstrat.com. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Women of Washington, Wednesday afternoons at 1 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.